it's Elise here with the first episode of the Real Scary Podcast. Woohoo! So if you haven't read my first blog post on my website that gives you an introduction into the podcast and myself, I'll give you a brief overview. My goal with this podcast is to bring you real stories about real people and real places that involve the paranormal. I want you all to come out of this with the knowledge that true scary stories may not be the Hollywood definition of jump out of your skin scary. In fact, some stories are healing for people. Some are kind of silly or mischievous. And yes, some are exactly what you would expect and downright creepy. You'll find a bit of everything here, and I will always follow up each episode with a corresponding blog post where you can see any evidence I was able to find, photos of people and places, and the things that we talk about in each episode. And sometimes even extra stories exclusive to the blog, so make sure that you check that out. I decided to focus on Canada, and I'm moving from west to east coast by province. So first we'll be looking at the amazingly beautiful province of British Columbia. The first 7 episodes will be about BC, and I'm always looking for story submissions or suggestions. And lastly, I would also like to thank all of my friends and family who have encouraged me to follow this crazy, crazy idea of mine, to the great people of BC who have responded to me and who have given me a chance to share their stories. Thank you so much, and I hope you all enjoy. So the first episode is about haunted objects. And the first province we're going to be exploring is the beautiful province of British Columbia. My first story comes from the small but mighty museum in Quesnel. The museum is home to thousands of artifacts depicting the rich history of Quesnel and area. With so many interesting artifacts, the museum does not have a problem attracting visitors. However, there's one item in particular that has gained international recognition, and truly international recognition. The Quesnel and District Museum is home to Mandy the Doll. Mandy has been described as Canada's Annabelle. Yep, that Annabelle. Focus of the movie series and the subject of one of the most famed cases by the equally well-known demonologist team Ed and Lorraine Warren. For those of you who don't know who Annabelle is or need a refresher, you can read more about her at warrens.net/Annabelle/, and I'll have a link in the show notes as well as my website in the first episode post. Back to our Mandy. In 1991, she was brought into the museum for donation. The 90-year-old doll was quite unsettling to look at, and truthfully, she still is. Her old dress was showing its age, her stuffed body was ripped in a few places, but most unnerving of all was her face. Cracks spider from her forehead, down over her right eye and onto her cheek. There are dark stains around her mouth that just add to her creep factor. All of these things are made even more chilling by the smiling expression frozen on her face despite the trauma. This is the image guests see to this day, only with clothing in better condition. The woman who brought Mandy in had enough. She had enough of the eerie things that were happening in her home, and she attributed them all to the doll. The donor had been awoken multiple times by the sound of crying coming from the basement where Mandy was kept. One night, after hearing crying, she went down into the basement to find a window open and Mandy gone, only to return to her spot in the basement the next morning. Now, there are a few versions of this story. The other version of this window story is that she saw the window open and then turned to see Mandy looking right at her. And the last version is that the windows on the upper level were closed when she checked the basement, but open when she went back upstairs. Either way it happened, I would have been scared shitless, truthfully, but not wanting to destroy the historical doll, and kudos to her for that. She decided that maybe the museum would be better equipped to handle Mandy and all of her quirks. It's believed that Mandy was made in Germany between 1900 and 1920. Now I'll say this, there's a very well-known and accepted story of Mandy's possible origins. However, this has not been confirmed by any sources and may just be legend, but I'll include it for your consideration anyway. So as legend has it, a man was out for a leisurely walk through the woods, and as he made his way by an abandoned farmhouse, he distinctly heard a child crying. The man knew the farmhouse was not inhabited, so hearing a child crying inside was definite cause for concern. He knocked on the door just in case there were in fact people inside, but when no one answered, he entered. The crying continued and the man quickly realized that the child must be in the basement, as the noise was coming from under his feet. He made his way down the stairs and the crying ceased. As his vision adjusted to the dark basement, he made a haunting and heartbreaking discovery. On the floor was the body of a young girl who had clearly been deceased for a long time, and in her arms was the doll that we would come to know as Mandy. If this is true, it definitely supports the crying in the basement and the mischievous childlike events that seem to follow Mandy. Possibly the young girl's spirit could be attached to her beloved doll who kept her company in that basement in the dark. Or it was a story concocted specifically to fit to make an interesting backstory, which happens a lot of the time. Either way, it's pretty interesting. Now, as I was doing my research, I found a video of an interview with the curator in the 90s for a little docuseries. She said that Mandy had belonged to a family in England who had twins and both died of polio. So this is really interesting as well. Could both stories be true? Could Mandy have made her way to this family after being discovered in the house, or vice versa? So maybe elements of each story have some truth, but we'll never know. Once Mandy arrived at the Quesnel Museum, she made her existence known. There are many stories floating around about strange noises, malfunctioning technology, and missing or moved objects in the museum. While no one at the museum has ever reported hearing a child cry, the previous owner did say that the cries ended once Mandy was gone. One story I've heard numerous times is that when objects came into the museum and were made of fabric, they would be placed in a bag or wrapped in plastic for an allotted period of time to ensure there were no insects present. If there were, the insects would be caught in the bag, and then proper measures could be taken to prepare the object for exhibit. For the duration of the time that Mandy was in the plastic, the workers in the museum reported hearing rustling. Now, this could have been explained away if there were insects found, which is what they thought. But the bag and Mandy were clean when they removed it. It appeared that it took a little while for Mandy to find a comfortable spot in the museum. When Mandy was placed in a section with other antique dolls, she seemed to make it known that she did not like that arrangement. The other dolls would be found knocked over or in other areas completely in the museum. She finally ended up in her own display case, but a worker thought she might need a little bit of company, so they put a little lamb plush in there with her. She seems to enjoy the lamb for the most part. However, there have been reports of the lamb being found outside of her closed case or in a different position inside. For the past while, though, it seems as though Mandy is pretty content in her own case with her stuffed lamb, and her activity for the most part seems to have calmed down. I did reach out to the museum and ended up chatting with the museum manager, Elizabeth, who sent me some more information and recent stories about Mandy. And she even confirmed a story that seems to go hand in hand with this doll. This story also takes place in those first few days at the museum in 1991. The museum assistant at the time was tasked with Mandy's first photo session. This is also a regular process that all new artifacts go through for record keeping. She finished photographing Mandy for the day and left her in the locked lab overnight. The next morning, she found that it was in a state of disarray. Objects had been thrown about the room and across the floor, and the curator at the time described the sight as what it would have looked like if a child threw a tantrum. Elizabeth met this woman last year, who repeated the story to her, and Elizabeth told her Mandy seemed pretty calm now. Elizabeth suggested maybe she should go see her, see if there's a difference in Mandy's energy. The woman flat out refused, genuinely afraid to go look or be near Mandy again. Elizabeth and the current workers have not experienced anything themselves, but continue to be told by visitors of witnessing Mandy moving, of her eyes following them, and of photos taken only to disappear from their device by the time they get home. As with other haunted dolls, specifically Robert the doll, and I'll include a link for him in my episode 1 post along with Annabelle, it appears to be a common thread that they don't care for their pictures to be taken. though taking Robert's photo without permission can apparently result in far more sinister events. She told me of a time that some investigators came in, set up all of their equipment to monitor Mandy overnight, and shortly after they left, you guessed it, the fancy camera shut down. They did record some sound, but there was no image. Though they didn't catch anything visually, they did confirm that there were unusual energy levels coming from Mandy. She also noted that one of the investigators seemed to go into a trance in front of the doll's case and became ill. Much like other incidents with Mandy, it doesn't appear that any event is isolated. Reports of people feeling ill or very strange are common when it comes to Mandy. Apparently, the museum had originally put Mandy right in the front display, but not for long, as people complained of headaches and even nightmares from just looking at Mandy through the window. Elizabeth also remembered a time that a girl had traveled to see Mandy specifically and fainted in front of her case. She was taken to the hospital and kept for observation overnight due to very low blood pressure. So was this a coincidence? Could be, but I'm not so sure. So let me know what you think in the comments. If you'd like to visit Mandy for yourself, check out quinnellmuseum.ca for more information. I'll link that in the show notes and in the episode blog as well. And I will say you are allowed to take photographs of Mandy without flash, though it might not turn out or still be there when you get home. Another thing to remember is that Mandy is not for sale. I asked Elizabeth if they've ever had offers from people to buy Mandy. She said actually people call quite frequently, asking if she's been sold or if the museum is willing to sell her. Why? Why do you want Mandy? Do you want a phantom baby crying? Come on, people. So for everyone out there who might be thinking of asking, they have no intention of selling Mandy, ever. I'd like you to know that if you do visit the museum, Mandy is not the only paranormally interesting item there. Elizabeth told me of a couple other objects that have had activity around them. There's a gallery dedicated to portraits from Mr. Hoy. The Hoy family was a very large local family with 12 children. 12! I can't imagine 12 children, geez. Mr. Hoy was a photographer and ran the general store in Quesnel. Recently, Elizabeth told me they've installed an exhibit with some of the family's personal items, including an old baby walker. And man, that thing must have seen some miles on it, going through 12 kids. Though Elizabeth reiterated she's not sensitive to energy from objects, she was approached by a visitor and her son, who said that they both experienced strange feelings when they looked at the walker. And they experienced the same feeling at one other area in the museum, but they couldn't connect it to anything in particular. So Elizabeth asked them about the second location, and it turned out to be the place where the walker had been previously displayed unbeknownst to these visitors. So that's super interesting, and I don't know if this exhibit will be a more permanent one, so if you want to see that baby walker, I suggest you maybe go to the museum sooner rather than later. The final item that she told me about is an item in the back gallery. There's a mannequin displaying a World War II military uniform. On one occasion, a group had come in after hours to conduct an investigation. The investigator, who happened to be ex-military, noticed that there was an incorrect badge on the hat. He called out at the mannequin, "Soldier, don't you know that it's a court-martialable offense to be out of uniform?" At this very moment, the nearest emergency exit blew open. Elizabeth describes the scene as very dramatic. And I quote, "I have been here 12 years, and the only other time during a really strong windstorm, one door was found open during an emergency check. In that case," she says, "the latch was not engaged and had come open." Makes sense. "But in this case, the door was latched and it blew open free of any wind at all at the very moment the investigator made his statement." So if you do end up going to the Quesnel Museum, check out these last two objects and try to take a picture. I'm really curious. I'd love to see what they look like. Now, our last little story comes from the historical Roadhouse in Vancouver, BC. I really love this story because even though this is the Real Scary Podcast, not all true stories are scary, but still very interesting. So I've corresponded with Kelsey, the current museum manager, who told me that she hasn't really experienced anything paranormal here, but for one instance. A beautiful antique 1906 German Jungen clock. Okay, I'm going to say this. I'm not German, so I do not know if I'm saying this correctly, but this is my educated guess, so that's what I'm sticking with. So this clock was donated to the museum in 2014 and resides atop a cabinet in the house's parlor. When Kelsey began as manager last year, she had never once heard it tick or chime, and neither had either of her coworkers. However, one morning in December, after Kelsey arrived to work after the weekend, she was working in the upstairs and began to hear music coming from somewhere in the house. She was alone, and she went downstairs to investigate. You're brave, Kelsey. To her surprise, the clock was playing, as she put it, a lovely Westminster chime. Later that day, her coworker let her know that during a classical concert the day prior, the clock suddenly started to chime. Kelsey thought that perhaps a board member had decided to fix it or wind it up for the first time, but after emailing around, no one had done either. This is a mystery that to this day, they still don't know how this clock could have suddenly started working. Kelsey likes to think that the classical Christmas music that Sunday brought the clock back to life that cool afternoon. She now refers to it as the Christmas clock, as it continued to chime and make music through the entire month of December. But it stopped by the time she was back to work in the new year and has not made a peep since. I contacted a man over Facebook who does clock and watch repair and is a self-described expert. As much of an expert as you can really be. He claimed that it all relies on whether or not this clock works off a balance-regulated movement. I have no idea what this means, but this is what he said. So if it doesn't, then he has no explanation. If this is a balance-regulated movement clock, and the clock was donated in a wound-up state, it's possible it's been stuck all of this time, and that a bump or a vibration could have jostled it to life. Now, it would have worked until the clock wound down, which he said would be about 2 weeks. It's possible, but it's kind of hard to imagine that over the time it's been there, there hasn't been any movement or bumping or jostling. They've never touched the clock or moved it enough that it would have started. So this part's a little hard to reconcile, but it's the one and only possible explanation that I was able to track down. Next time you're in Vancouver, and particularly in the month of December, take a little trip over to the beautiful roadhouse and see if you're able to catch the song of the Christmas clock. Thank you so much to Elizabeth and Kelsey for the story submissions and the help on this episode. I've yet to visit these places myself, but I look forward to checking them out, and I will definitely be keeping in touch with Kelsey. I really want to know if that Christmas clock strikes again this December. See what I did there? Strikes again. If you have visited these places and have your own experiences to share, or if you have your own story, big or small, please send me an email at realscarypodcast@gmail.com. And I hope you'll also hit the subscribe button if you enjoy what you heard today. And please follow me on Facebook and Instagram at realscarypodcast. And lastly, please don't forget to check out my website at, you guessed it, realscarypodcast.ca, where you can check out the blog post for episode 1. In it, you'll find photos of the objects we chatted about today, as well as the links to the $2 that I mentioned from the United States. I hope you'll tune in next time. Episode 2 is all about hauntings in Fernie, and you will not want to miss that one. Until next time, this is your friendly neighborhood host, Elise.